This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
I started a joke, it started the whole world crying, but I didn't see that the joke was on me.
Place to Be Nation pop listeners, welcome to yet another edition of your weekly destination for comic book musings, bad to average impersonations, and inside jokes no one could possibly get. The hard traveling fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is the other hard traveling fanboy, Nick Duke. We are here in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, enjoying this beautiful Canadian summer. Nick, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, sir, and I would remind you once more that we're not just their weekly destination, but we are, after all, the longest running
weekly
episodic comic book podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history.
Yep. That's so correct.
Just to remind you of that.
That's an indisputable fact, just like it's an indisputable fact that 29,000 people packed into Madison Square Garden to watch Big Daddy Cool Diesel wrest the title from Bob Backlund in 8 seconds.
In 8 seconds, that's absolutely right. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it's good to think happy thoughts in dark times such as these, where we're still having to go through the 7 stages of grief as it relates to the recent departure of our beloved Ho-Ho Loon.
I have to be honest, Nick. Right now, I'm mainly in the anger phase, and I've been stuck in the anger phase.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am as well. The no good Noam Dar needs to be stretched by the Zack Sabre.
That's right.
Help me get over that, but I don't know if that's going to happen or not.
At the very least, humbled by the Iron Sheik.
Well, I mean, you know, let's not get our hopes up here.
We are definitely in a post-Ho-Ho Loon world, and we'll have to see how that goes and how that adjusts to it, how both the major comic book companies react to this news. You know, we haven't had a lot of time yet for them to get a special edition out in honor of
this. Yeah, I mean, like, if you remember in the wake of 9/11, you know, they had the issue with Spider-Man helping at Ground Zero, and I feel like now's the time for an issue where perhaps, you know, Miles Morales or somebody like that goes and, you know, helps people through the grieving process after losing Ho-Ho Loon.
That's right. Maybe an issue where all 19 Hulks converge on Noam Dar.
That's true.
To get revenge. Frank Miller can write that one.
And I'm pretty sure that me comparing Ho-Ho Loon's loss to 9/11 is a new low for our podcast.
I agree. That it won't get much worse than that. So let's just move along and get on to the show as normal, and hope that people will forget this opening salvo here. We are here to give you our usual weekly spiel of what you're reading, what you're watching, except, as usual, we're not watching anything except the subject of today's podcast, which I should mention, by the way. This is actually Off the Page, and this edition of Off the Page is going to be taking a look at the recent animated feature from Warner Brothers Animation, Batman the Killing Joke. We will get into that later, our detailed review of that feature. And
certainly a somewhat controversial, not just controversial film, but of course a controversial film adaptation of a controversial comic book itself.
As you know, folks, controversy creates cash. Except in this case, where we're not going to be making any damn money.
Hey, you never know. As we found out on Twitter, the old Chad Campbell was able to quit his job thanks to revenues from the podcast, so maybe one day we'll be as lucky.
It's the next step for us is immortality.
There can be only one.
That's right. And in any event, we're not watching anything because there's nothing on. But I'm also not reading anything because as some of you in the know may have heard,
I had
an unfortunate misunderstanding with my in my real life, and I'll suffice to say I did not receive my paycheck when I thought I would be receiving my paycheck, and thus I am delayed yet again from getting my last month's worth of comics. But I do.
So be sure to tune in next week for Greg reviewing comic books from a month ago.
Exactly. That's exactly what it's going to be. I'm going to go ahead and warn everybody. I have a lot of catching up to do. I've got at least 3 new Rebirth specials to read. I've got a whole bunch of continuing comics to read. It's a lot on my plate. But I did find the time in my busy schedule to read a few comics that I had sitting around. Namely, Batgirl and the Birds of Prey Rebirth. Finally read that. Highly impressed by the writing. I thought the characterizations were strong. Batgirl was written better than she is in her solo title. Batgirl was written in a way that made me want to read more of her adventures and not less. Huntress was written more compellingly than I've seen her. Now, I didn't read Grayson, but she was more compelling in this than she was in the last several times she popped up in Batman stories before the New 52. And Black Canary is identifiable here and meshes with the version that we see in Green Arrow. So I was a fan of the Rebirth issue. The art, not so much. Particularly the fact that the women seem to have the face of Vanderlei Silva, which is not a good thing, even for Vanderlei Silva. So that was somewhat unique. Also, I read Detective Comics 935 and 936.
I know. Finally getting on the Detective Comics train.
Very good. Very compelling. Very interesting stuff. It actually makes me want to go back and read all the Batwoman books. All of them. Going back to Greg Rucka and J.H. Williams III doing it after 52. Because I enjoyed her in 52, but I really am enjoying her in this Detective Comics run. And also all the other characters as well. They're doing a wonderful job of making everybody seem important. Clayface is a standout in the issues that I've read. And, of course, I've still got a lot more to read on this. So that's what I've been reading, folks. And next week I should have a bunch more to add to that. Nick, what you been reading?
Well, going to our usual format of top three, bottom, and our bottom one.
Right.
I'm going to start this week with my bottom one. And I will say, you know, we've done this before, and we have said that it's tough to pick a bottom book because you didn't read any bad books that week. And that, you know, this is certainly true for this week. I would say this is probably the best book I've been forced to list as my bottom book thus far. But I'm going to go with Titans number 2. The writing in this issue is actually really good. I think the plot's intriguing. I think they do a good job of helping each character to have a distinct voice and giving each character a moment to shine. The problem with this is I'm not as low on Brett Booth as you are as an artist, but I thought this was his worst work on the series thus far. One thing I've noticed on several of these Rebirth titles is as the series goes on, it seems as if the art starts to slip a little bit. And I don't know if that's the artist feeling rushed because of the compressed publishing schedule or what's going on, but this is another case of it just felt to me like the art was a little bit too rushed, a little bit too unpolished. Really did not enjoy the art in this issue is what I'm driving at. But overall, still a solid issue and nothing that's really going to affect Titan's place on my pull list.
So another case of a good book on our bad list.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So jumping over to my top three books of the week. First up. At number three, excuse me. I've got Star Wars 22. The only Marvel book I bought this week, and it made it into my top three. This continues to be just outstanding comics each and every week. Jason Aaron has a great handle on the characters of Luke, Han, and Leia. I mean, his dialogue is so good that you can't help. You know, you read the book in the voices of Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, and Harrison Ford, and it sounds natural in your head as you're doing it because the book is just so well written. I'm intrigued to see how this book will handle Darth Vader once his solo title wraps up, if he'll be able to be more regularly featured in this title. I'm really not sure what the plan for it is, but at this point, it doesn't need Darth Vader. The book has been so great without him that I really have no complaints about this book, and this was just another outstanding issue. So big shout out to Star Wars number 22.
You say Han. I don't know anyone named Han. I only know Han Solo.
And that's really the biggest question, is if they do wind up going with Michael B. Jordan or Donald Glover as young Lando in the Solo standalone movie, will he bring over the pronunciation of Han?
That's the question. He has to. And there needs to – I've mentioned this before, Nick. You know this is a sticking point for me. If you're going to tell a prequel, I need an explanation. I need some sort of frame of reference to A, why Lando calls him Han, and B, why Han lets him call him Han.
In any event, moving on to my number two book of the week, I'm going with Detective Comics 939. I will not say much here because I know you're rapidly trying to catch up. I thought the art in this book was outstanding from Eddie Barrows. I think James Tynion IV continues to write the hell out of these characters. And this is a book that seemingly pulled off the impossible, something that hasn't happened often in my life. It made me actively want to read a Tim Drake solo series written by James Tynion IV.
What?
This is mostly a Tim Drake-focused issue, and it works, man. It works completely, complete with Tim making a very heroic decision near the end of the book that I don't want to spoil, but I can't wait for you to finally get caught up on this series. This is, to this point, the best Batman series of Rebirth over the solo title, and granted, it's only one issue in, but right now, this is better than All-Star Batman, which I never thought I would say. So yeah, Detective Comics takes the number two spot on my list. Number one, however, and this is a wide gap between my number two and my number one this week, Wonder Woman number 5 comes in at my number one spot, and I thought this was the best issue of Wonder Woman thus far. You get a little bit more on the Cheetah's backstory. You get a little bit more on, you know, what her and Diana's relationship is now and what it used to be. And you get a little bit more of how Steve Trevor figures into all of this and how he will factor in to this plot getting ready to wrap up. But it just continues to be an outstanding book, the most literary book of Rebirth thus far. And, of course, Liam Sharp, who recently became a DC Comics exclusive, continues to kill it on the art. Wonder Woman number 5 is my number one book of the week.
I was about to ask if that was a Liam Sharp book. That's a big hire by DC, getting him exclusive. They also just they also just today announced that they've got Rafael Sandoval as an exclusive as well now. So pretty good artistic hires there from old DC Comics there.
Got it. And then a few quick hits, just very quickly. Action Comics 962, enjoyed this book. Wraps up the Doomsday storyline in a little bit of a convenient fashion, in my opinion, but leaves the door just a crack open enough that Doomsday could play a role down the road in a very intriguing fashion that I don't want to spoil here.
He does not turn into a diarrhea cloud, I'm assuming.
No diarrhea cloud, no.
Good.
Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 3. This book continues to be a massive course correction from Venditti's previous Green Lantern work. I don't know what happened, but he just all of a sudden figured out how to write Hal Jordan finally. This has got two or three distinct moments where you go, man, that's Hal Jordan, and a moment where you go, man, that's Guy Gardner. Just outstanding work from Mr. Venditti on this title. And then finally, a book that I don't know that it's on my pull list yet, but this Rebirth issue has certainly got me intrigued anyway, and that's Blue Beetle Rebirth. I read this, and I very much enjoyed the Keith Giffen dialogue. It's much like Birds of Prey in that the art is kind of weird, and I don't really know how I feel about it, but the writing was good enough to buy this. At least I'm going to get the number one whenever it comes out and kind of see how this series goes along. And this could potentially become another book from Rebirth that I wasn't expecting to be on my pull list that kind of winds up shoving its way on, unfortunately.
I'm very excited to read it. It's on. I've got the Rebirth issue on my pull to try out, so I'm excited about it. You know, I'm a sucker for Giffen, and the Giffen and Scott Collins team was a good one on Larfleeze. And also, what was the name of the book that came before Larfleeze that they did? That was a kind of a Green Lantern comedy book in space. I'm drawing a blank, but I enjoyed that one too. So I'm looking forward to this and seeing how
Threshold.
Threshold. Yep. Thank you.
You're welcome.
But yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. Should be a fun ride.
Absolutely. Well, that's all I got for this week.
Awesome. Well, that brings us to the rundown. Your weekly dose of comic book news and notes of interest. And while we're talking about DC Comics, we mentioned the hiring of Liam Sharp. Let's move on. Most of our news this week is going to be in the cinematic side or the television side. Let's go to the cinematic side and hit you with the biggest news story of this week, in all likelihood, which is Deathstroke. Ben Affleck tweeted out this week what appeared to be test footage
of some kind.
Of someone in Deathstroke armor, and it set the internet ablaze, kicked off tons of speculation. Is Deathstroke going to be in Justice League? What's going on? Then there was a report from the oft-maligned, oft-praised Umberto Gonzalez, who is not to be confused with a certain country music aficionado in the Troy, Alabama area, but he is he reported that Deathstroke is going to be the main villain of the Ben Affleck standalone Batman movie.
Right.
Whether you buy that or not is up to the listener or the viewer. I have my doubts, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility either. Nick, your thoughts on A, the Deathstroke footage, B, what it means, and C, the rumor about the Batman movie.
And I'll throw in a bonus point of D, and I'll actually lead with D. There was also a rumor that came across the interwebs this week that Joe Manganiello will be playing Deathstroke.
Who?
Or whatever.
Who played Flash Thompson in Sam Raimi's Spider-Man.
Yes, and also had a recurring role in How I Met Your Mother. He's also known for True Blood, I believe.
He also appeared on Raw one time.
He's done some work in the Magic Mike male stripper films, apparently. You know, those sorts of – those old chestnuts. But in any event, what were your questions again?
What was your reaction to the footage?
My reaction was, oh, my God, holy shit.
Yeah, me too.
Because this – I mean, like – here's the thing. The footage is essentially like a glorified GIF. Like, it's not that long, and you really don't see him do much other than just stand there. So really all you can evaluate is, oh my God, that's Deathstroke, and does the suit look cool? And the suit looks awesome, man. It looks like they just lifted it directly from the comic book page. I love Arrow, and I loved the way Arrow handled Deathstroke, but I think just based on this, if this is the suit we're going to get, it'll be the coolest Deathstroke suit done on film yet,
see,
in my opinion.
I actually think I like the Arrow suit a little bit better because I like the practicality of the Arrow suit.
But yeah, but the Arrow suit feels too clunky to me. Like, it felt like it would hinder Deathstroke's movement and keep him from being as quick. And this just seems a little bit more sleek. The reds are a little brighter and they pop. It's got a kind of a shiny black finish to it. I just loved everything
about it. I liked it. I liked it for sure. And
plus the subtle thing of the tassel waving in the wind behind his head, I also mm-hmm. like that as well.
So what do you think the footage means?
I think it means he's at least making some sort of an appearance in Justice League, honestly. I can't see them shooting footage for a solo Batman movie when Justice League isn't even done, hasn't even wrapped yet from what I understand.
Right.
So I would think it'd have to be something for Justice League.
Right. I would think so.
And then as far as the solo Batman thing goes, I don't really know what to make of that. I tend to not believe it just because, you know, we don't know. I mean, we still don't know when that movie's coming. And I have a hard time believing that Ben Affleck, of all people, would want to put out, you know, major plot details for a movie that isn't even dated yet. You know, and so I don't know whether to buy that or not. But if it's true, my expectations are for essentially the best hand-to-hand superhero fight scenes ever.
Right.
Because the way – say what you will about Batman v Superman, but the way Bruce's fighting style was depicted in that movie was the best on-screen
right.
adaptation of Batman in action we've gotten
Agreed.
This far.
Agreed.
And if you give Deathstroke the same level of attention and care that Batman got in that, my expectations for the fight scenes alone are through the roof, man. So we'll see how it goes. We'll see what happens from here, but I'm certainly excited. It's freaking Deathstroke.
Absolutely. Deathstroke's awesome. I would be slightly perturbed if he is the main villain of a Batman movie at first, probably because...
Really? Why?
Only because... Let me explain. Because there are so many Batman villains that have not gotten their just due, whether it be someone like the Riddler, who's been in a movie but it sucked, or my boy Hush, who I'm still holding out hope for in a movie. That would be my main point of disappointment. However, I would get over it like Dr. Evil said he would get over it if Mini-Me died. He'd have a 10-second mourning period, and then he'd move on to the next one. And then I'd have a 10-second mourning period for the Hush movie still not happening. And then I'd be like, it's freaking Deathstroke versus Batman. What's not to love?
Exactly.
So, yeah, that would be awesome if that were to happen.
And let's not forget, that gives you the possibility of a little Jeremy Irons versus Wintergreen action
Ooh,
as well.
Ooh, Wintergreen. Yes. Now, let me ask you this, Nick. What, though, let's look at it from a more negative side here, because what about the caveat to that, that the reason that Arrow hasn't been able to bring Deathstroke back is because he's being used in the movies?
You know, that it's certainly it's a policy I don't agree with, because unless you're planning on canceling the Flash, which would be a stupid, stupid decision on their part, you're already violating that rule anyway. And the Flash at this point has introduced pretty much every villain you could possibly hope to use, you know, in a Flash movie. There was even that report that the Flash movie was directly going to feature Eobard Thawne and the Reverse Flash in the first movie, which was essentially the first season of Flash. So I don't know. It sucks for sure, but I'm hoping at some point DC will realize there's really no point to doing that anymore and let Deathstroke, you know, let there be separate incarnations of these characters.
Yeah.
Because if the other rumors about the first Flash movie are true and they wind up doing the Rogues, then are they really going to take Captain Cold off of the show, seeing as how they just bumped Wentworth Miller up to series regular? Or excuse me, universe regular. Recurringly featured in across all four shows. No, I don't think that's going to happen. So my hope is that we could start to see a little bit of a weakening of that policy.
Agreed. Totally agreed. It's an outdated policy that needs to go away. But moving on to the next topic of discussion, let's stick with DC for now.
Let's save that one for last.
Okay, we'll save the DC one for last. Let's move on to Marvel now, where the much beloved Vince Russo brothers, who directed Captain America: Civil War, have announced that Steve Rogers, when he gives the shield away, is ceremonially giving up the mantle of Captain America. Not really a huge deal, I suppose, but could be potentially in the cinematic universe the opening for another character to claim the mantle of Captain America, which we have not really seen in any of the movies so far. We haven't seen that inheriting of the mantle yet. So that could be a potentially interesting scenario, or it could be an Iron Man 3 situation where he just picks up the shield again like nothing happened in the next movie. So, or has a new shield made for him. Who knows? Nick, your thoughts?
Don't really have many thoughts on this one. I would say I kind of got that from Civil War anyway. Like, that was kind of the impression I got, seeing as how the next time we see him after he drops the shield, he's in plain clothes, you know, for the big spoilers breakout scene at the end. So I'm thinking they're going to do whatever their version of I guess what Nomad would be. And this would open the door to having a new Captain America, whether that be the Winter Soldier or whether that be the Falcon in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But I don't think this by any stretch of the imagination means the end of Steve Rogers. I think it just means the end of Steve Rogers as Captain America for now. Because I think we all are assuming that Steve's going to play a big, big role in Infinity War when that comes in a couple of years.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that. It's I think they're going to do a mini version of their Nomad story, and hopefully they'll give us a scene in the movie where he refers to himself as Nomad. Other than that, I think ultimately I think this will last maybe the course of a movie, if that. I can't imagine them going an entire movie without having Captain America be Captain America, personally. So, but we'll see. We'll see how it turns out. I'm excited about it. It's gonna be great. But
hey guys,
let's
get I'm
something that's not great. Nick, do you wanna take point on this one?
Yeah, you know, I think I do.
Down the rap-
I think I do want to take point on this one. So, you know, we have, you and I, and various other Place to Be Nation comics contributors on the Twitter machine and whatnot, have been very vocal in our disdain for the television show Gotham. Going so far as to label it with the hashtag Gotham Sucks line that we love to bust out whenever given the opportunity.
Mm.
And, you know, I gotta be honest. After this week and reading an interview with showrunner Bruno Heller, I've never felt more justified in shitting all over the show than I do right now. And let me tell you...
Let me tell you why.
Apparently, Heller was at the Edinburgh Television Festival and gave an interview this week, and this is what he said when asked if Batman or any other DC heroes would be making an appearance on Gotham in the near future. He said, and I quote, "I don't think superheroes work very well on TV, probably because of the costume thing. TV is about real people and faces, and not so much about magic and the supernatural things. Gotham has to be both a crime procedural and a mythic, epic, grand comic book saga. It's a tricky combination because you have to keep it real and unreal at the same time."
There's never, ever been a successful TV show about magic or supernatural things. There's never been a show called Supernatural that's run for 10 seasons almost.
There aren't numerous instances on one network in the last 3 years of great comic book television working just fine with costumed heroes each and every week.
TV is about real people and faces, Nick. I will remind you of that quote from Mr. Heller. Real people and faces. That's what it's about. It's not about a man and a talking car. It's not about a helicopter called Airwolf. It's not about any of that stuff. It's not about a green monster played by Lou Ferrigno. It's about real people, things that people can really sink their teeth into. It's about generic police procedurals, Nick. That's what television is.
And it's about Jada Pinkett Smith's overacting. It's about characters named Dr. Dolemacher.
And Ivy Pepper.
Oh my god. It's about a character who's going to grow up to be Catwoman, and you have to signify that she's going to grow up to be Catwoman.
By
having people call her cat, and having her pounce on things like a cat, and perch on everything like a cat.
And then have Harvey Bullock say that she moves around like a cat.
It's about having characters who are going to become the Riddler, and have Harvey Bullock say in every episode, "Oh damn it, Nygma, why don't you stop with the riddles?"
It's about reminding the viewers every episode for an entire season that Oswald Cappelpoot walks like a penguin.
It's about having a weird subplot where Carol Kane wants to have sex with her son.
It's about having villains who are going to be geriatric by the time Batman comes to be.
It's about having a version of Jim Gordon that has nothing to do with any version of Jim Gordon ever produced on television, and taking a character who should be compelling and making him boring as hell.
It's about having Jim Gordon, you know, a real person with a real face, act exactly like you'd have Batman act in the show, and use the same voice that you'd have Batman use in the show.
It's about coming up with a 12-year-old kid who can't act for shit and trying to, like, imply that he would be the worst version of the Joker ever imagined.
And calling him Jerome.
Jerome. You know, here's the thing. I can deal with a lot of people saying that they don't enjoy superhero television, and they don't think shows like Arrow or The Flash or Legends of Tomorrow or Supergirl or Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or Smallville or, let's see, Batman the Animated Series or
the Incredible Hulk.
Any of the numerous successful superhero television shows in history. I can deal with somebody who's actually a good showrunner saying these things. But when somebody like Bruno Heller, who can't make a cohesive Batman show to save his fucking life, is running his mouth and saying stupid shit like this, it just makes me write off Gotham even more than I already had. To the point where it doesn't just suck. It's one of the worst things, and I'm ready for it to end. I'm sorry. This show needs to go away so that we can get, I don't know, a good Batman show on television.
Or at least a show that is run by someone who isn't a turd in the punch bowl of life like this guy.
I mean, pretentious Richard, if you will.
He just backhandedly or front-handedly insulted all of the shows at the CW, all of Marvel shows, but all of the DC properties that have ever existed on television, essentially, by saying they can't work. They just won't work. Can't have superheroes on television.
I know it's not cable television, or it's not broadcast television like his is, but if you count the Marvel Netflix shows, I would argue those shows are as human and as real, quote-unquote, as they get. And yet they feature costume characters, they feature characters with superpowers, and they are approximately 10,000 freaking times the show that Gotham is, or percent 1,000, if you will.
Well, of all the people that need to be humbled by the Sheiky Baby.
It's Bruno Heller. Fuck this guy.
Yep.
Shut the fuck up. Go away. Kiss my ass, you lousy bastard.
Maven, Raven.
Raven, my ass.
Now, you know, I read this interview too, Nick. You can find it on Newsarama.com, ladies and gentlemen. It's something else. And I was very frustrated by it. And he's now on my crap list. But not as far on my crap list as the no good bastard Noam Dar. But that's
a no good bastard Noam Dar.
That's another story for another time. Suffice it to say, we have nothing against anyone that does like Gotham, but hashtag Gotham sucks. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we come to the end of our rundown segment. But before we take a break, ladies and gentlemen, I've got a message for a certain Place to Be Nation newcomer, a Kelly Pugh, who wanted to call me out on the Sellers Point podcast. You can find it right here on PTB and Pop. Every 2 weeks here on the PTB and Pop feed. Anyway,
that's PTB and Pop. Fight like you mean it.
POP. And folks, I want to talk to you for a minute about Mon-El. I want to tell you something about Mon-El. I know Mon-El. And Mon-El can't beat Kal-El. Now, can you argue with that? Can you disagree with that? Hell no. We'll be back right after this, ladies and gentlemen.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzuto here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
You were the first thing that I thought of when I thought I drank you off my mind. When I get lost in the liquor, you're the only one I find. If I did the things I ought to, still would not be mine. So I keep a tight grip on the bottle, getting loose and killing time. This killing time is killing me. Drinking my supply.
Welcome back, folks, and I would like to apologize for my Jim Ross fueled rant before the break at Mr. Kelly Pool, who's a good dear friend of mine. I guess I just fell victim to my passions and my emotions, much like WWE superstar Luke Gallows' wife recently did on Twitter. So I do apologize for that. But that sets the stage, the main event of the evening, which in this case is our off-the-page look at the Bruce Timm produced WB Animation take on Batman the Killing Joke, the classic 1987, I believe.
Graphic, good question.
Graphic novel,
good question.
By Alan Moore and Brian Bolland, one of the most famous Batman stories of all time, the most famous Joker story of all time. And certainly
1988, Greg.
I was real close. I was real close.
Close. A for effort.
A for effort, that's right, which is a tease of things to come.
Indeed it is.
In the hard-traveling Fanboys universe.
Universe, yes.
Now, I actually went to see this film, this motion film, at the movie theater, the cinema, here in, or not here, because we're in Vancouver, of course, but there in my hometown of Dothan, Alabama. I witnessed it with several friends on the big screen, which was a really cool experience. First time I've ever had a chance to watch one of these DC animated films on a big screen, so that was cool. Now, I do not own a physical copy of it. Nick, however, does. And as you know, most weeks, or most months when we do these off-the-page broadcasts, both of us will throw the movie on, invite you to watch along with us, and we'll kind of use that to guide our discussion a little bit. We don't usually watch the whole thing. Nick, however, is the only one of us that has the physical copy, so he's going to kind of be doing that, and I'm just going to be kind of following his lead on a lot of this. But before we get to that, let's do a little build-up to this, because this movie is very controversial, but as we mentioned earlier in the broadcast, so is the book. So let's give you a little bit of a background for those of you who may not know what the background is to this story. The Killing Joke, as we mentioned, is a 1988 story by legendary comics writer Alan Moore and legendary comics artist Brian Bolland. I think that I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Apologies if I'm not, if it's Boland. Anyway, so this book is kind of meant as an examination of the relationship between Batman and the Joker, how they're two sides of a coin. And it was the first real take on the Joker's origin. Even though the Joker himself states in the book that it's multiple choice. In other words, he could just be making this all up. It could be figments of his imagination. It could just be visions that appear to him that he thinks are real. Even he can't tell. But it's the first attempt at a quote-unquote definitive origin for the Joker. It's designed to show how Batman and the Joker are locked in this eternal struggle and how they're mirror images and that both of them are defined by one bad day. And the Joker's argument is that Batman is just as capable of being pushed to the edge that he was pushed to. And ultimately, of course, that's what separates them, is that Batman has the strength of character and the resolve to withstand what he's been through. But you could argue that Jim Gordon is also the main character of this, because he is put through even more than Batman is in this story and stays the course, which is an inspiration for Bruce. All that being said, the source of controversy of this story has nothing to do with the Joker, has nothing to do with Batman. It has to do with Barbara Gordon. In 1988, as I understand it, now I was a young kid at the time, but as I've read back issues, Batgirl wasn't doing very much in the DC Universe. She may not have even been active at that time. Barbara Gordon was kind of a non-factor, not really doing a whole lot, not a huge part of any ongoings at the time. And so she is used in this story as, one might say, the impetus for the Joker's big plan to drive Jim Gordon crazy and to prove that even the best man can go crazy because of a bad day. Well, to do this, the Joker shows up at Barbara's apartment door and shoots her in the stomach and paralyzes her. And so in the story, she is left paralyzed, hospitalized by the Joker, all in an attempt to drive Jim Gordon nuts. Now, this is, in many eyes, the definition of a woman in a refrigerator situation, as they call it in comics. In other words, the usage of a female character as nothing but a motivating factor for a male character, in this case, Batman and Jim Gordon. So this has been a controversial story for many, 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 many years. Before we even get into the movie, do we want to touch on the book itself, Nick?
We can touch on it now, or we can touch on it as we go through the movie. I mean, I'm sure we'll have time to discuss a great many things, especially, I don't know, in the first 35 minutes of the movie.
Right. Precise. Yes, but I feel like a lot of the things that we're going to be discussing about the movie are perhaps differences between the movie and the book.
I would tend to agree, and what I am telling you is that I feel like if we go ahead and fire this thing up, we can talk about the book while there are other, shall we say, less interesting things happening on the screen.
All right, well, let's do it. Count the folks down.
All right,
Nick, tell them how.
If you've got your DVD player, your Blu-ray player, your game console, maybe you've got a digital copy. Hell, I don't know. Anyway, line it up at 0000. And press the play button in 3, 2, 1, go. And we are off, and we got the Warner Brothers animation logo. And here we go, The Killing Joke. So, the book, as you wanted to... I mean, what really do we need to cover? You kind of covered a general plot synopsis of... you know, what's going on here.
Yeah, it's such a dicey thing to discuss because...
And actually, I'm going to go ahead and throw you off topic because part of this, the whole problem with this movie, or the problem with the adaptation of the movie, is that people, you know, had an issue with depicting what happened to Barbara Gordon in such, in animated form, I think. And so, one thing we need to cover is these DC animated movies stick to a very strict 72-minute running time. I don't know what the reason for that is. I've never understood it, but they do it. In most cases, the problem is that the stories they are seeking to adapt are too long to fit into 72
right.
minutes. This is the first time they've ever had the opposite problem. I believe The Killing Joke, the original graphic novel, is only somewhere in the neighborhood of 55 pages, maybe? Somewhere
it's
in that,
short.
In that,
it's short by graphic novel standards, for sure.
It is not a long read at all. And so there was not enough here in the book to make a feature-length adaptation. So what you have is they came up with about a, what would you say, Greg, 30 to 35-minute, mm-hmm. what they call a prologue. And the reason why I wanted to throw you off is because that prologue opens, and it almost feels like a direct, like the creators, the writers, the director are speaking directly to the audience. Because the film opens with a voiceover from Barbara Gordon saying, "I bet you didn't think this is how this story was going to start." From the get-go, it seems like they are trying to make her the central character by having her be the voice that the audience is first introduced to. And it feels like it's their way of attempting to lessen, you know, the criticism, to confront it and hopefully get people on their side. And we will discuss as we go along whether or not that was effective or not. So anyway, back to our discussion of the book.
Yeah, so let's talk about why they felt the need to do that. The overwhelming criticism of this book, and it's divisive because it's considered by many to be one of the great Batman stories of all time. There is an equally loud contingent who this book causes very strong emotional reactions in, primarily women who feel that it's demeaning to women, that it is that it cheapens a strong female character only for the purpose of strengthening the male mentor character that she is with. It's a very dicey book to discuss because opinions are so hot on both sides on this. I can only speak from my experience with the book, and I've always considered it a great book, a very good book. I don't think that I consider it one of the best Batman books, but I think it is the best Joker book. And
it's an all-time classic,
yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah, and
I mean, yeah. Does that mean it's without its warts? Does that mean it's necessarily comfortable to praise and to, you know, speak glowingly about at times? No, it's not always comfortable, but that doesn't lessen my opinion.
And I would argue that a lot of great art is uncomfortable and should be uncomfortable.
That is my – if we want to boil it down to my ultimate thought on the issue, here's what it is. What happens to Barbara Gordon is reprehensible. It's awful. It's terrible. You would never want it to happen to a human being. You feel sorry for her, not just as a woman, but as a person. But that's the point. The Joker, too often, I feel like, is portrayed as this character that you love to hate and that you find endlessly entertaining despite the fact that he's a psychopath. And in this book, there are no redeeming qualities to the Joker. He is utterly, completely reprehensible. And to me, anyway, you need that at times. You need bad things to happen to good people. And I will admit, yes, they too often in comics, in disproportionate fashion, bad things happen to women and minorities more often than they happen to the traditional straight white male. However, I don't feel like you can necessarily keep score for years of straight white males being protected and say, all right, well, all women and minority characters are off the table for bad things happening to them until we catch up a little bit or whatever the rationale is. It's awful what happens to Batgirl. But I would argue, as you said, art is so sometimes supposed to be uncomfortable. And you aren't supposed to be comfortable when reading this or watching this with what happens to her. And I ultimately feel as if that's okay.
Yeah, it again, it's very, very dicey because I understand I completely empathize with and understand the complaints, and I understand the issues that people have with it, and I understand the problems that it raises within the industry as a whole. However, as an isolated work of art, I don't think it's fair to look at it in those terms. If you're going into it looking, how should I put this? If you're going into it with the expectation of, is this book going to do right by all the characters I want it to do right by? I don't think that's a fair expectation to have for an individual work. Now, in the greater sum of things, sure, but as an isolated work that you just go back and pick up and read now, even today, after everything, when I read this, I don't read this book and think this is about the degradation of Batgirl. I read this book and I think this is about a psychopath doing horrible things to Batgirl and to Jim Gordon. And I don't think of it as any different than Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs doing horrible things to women for, what, an hour and a half, 2 hours. You know, it's despicable people in fiction do despicable things. And in this case, Barbara Gordon was not the central character. Clarice Starling was the central character in Silence of the Lambs and saved the day. And maybe that would have made it better if there was a female character that could step in and be the central character here. But in this case, I feel like this was not about Batgirl. This was about the Joker. This was about a psychopath being brought down. And at that time, if Barbara Gordon's not being used in the comics as a whole, and if somebody can correct me on this, please do. I don't believe that she was being used in DC at that time. I think that she was a character that was kind of dragged out of the mothballs a little bit for this story. And I think in retrospect, with how popular Barbara Gordon has become, it's easy to look back and think of it as that would be like taking Kitty Pryde and doing the same thing to her. But it really wasn't, because Barbara wasn't at that level of notoriety, I think, and popularity that she later became. So it's a very dicey issue. I think the book holds up well. I think there are things about it that maybe don't. But I think on the whole, it holds up really well. The art is probably some of the best Batman art of all time.
And the writing. Yep. I mean, Alan Moore's writing of the Joker specifically, yep, is among the best Joker writing, yep, of all time. Right up there with Frank Miller and The Dark Knight Returns. I want to piggyback off something, yep, you just said, though, Greg, and I wanted to ask you this question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned at the time when this happened, Barbara Gordon did not enjoy the popularity that she does today. Controversial opinion incoming. I am of the belief that she never reaches that level of popularity without this story. Was that the intention when it happened?
No.
Of course not. Was it a direct result of this? No, but indirectly, I firmly believe the Killing Joke is responsible for the level of popularity that Batgirl / Barbara Gordon / Oracle enjoys today.
What was the line in Arrow season 2 about a crucible? About everybody has to go through their everybody has their crucible, and it's going through that that makes them who they are and what they are. And I think that what you're touching at is what John Ostrander did with Barbara in Suicide Squad, just maybe a year after this, or maybe even later in the same year, where he took what was done in the Killing Joke and used it to make Barbara Gordon a more compelling character. Because I believe that one of the things that makes fictional characters interesting and compelling and causes people to identify with them is that they go through crucibles. They go through destructive things that define who they are. Because it's not interesting to read somebody that never deals with bad things. It's more interesting to read somebody who has to overcome bad things and has to overcome tragedy, whether it be physical, whether it be mental, whether it be emotional, some form of pain and torture. They go through that pain, and you as a reader, you experience it with them, and you latch onto that, because who can't relate to that? Everybody can relate in some way to being hurt.
And you get to go on the journey of seeing them come out on the other side.
Yep.
You know, I'm biased, admittedly, because we've talked before on the show about how I love seeing our heroes put through the ringer. I love seeing them emotionally and physically beaten and almost tortured. Like, I don't know why I do, but that's why my tastes have always skewed towards what some would call the darker comic stories. And there are some who would argue or say that comics by their nature should not seek to address topics or themes such as those that are covered in The Killing Joke. I do not agree with that statement. Greg, I mean, what's your take on that specifically? Because we'll get into the implication of what exactly happens to Barbara later, but at a bare minimum, she is certainly physically violated and emotionally tortured.
Yeah, my stance on this is you cannot have your cake and eat it too when it comes to, do you want comic books to be considered as literature or not? And that's you can fall on either side of that debate. I do. If you do want comic books to be considered as literature, then they should be open to explore any of the themes that you would expect from a novel, from a play, from a film. Comic books are an art form like any other, and I feel like you can explore tons of headspace with certainly the medium of comics, but even within the medium, the genre of superheroes. Alan Moore was on the forefront of that with Frank Miller, of showing new genres that could be, or new themes that could be explored, questions of morality that could be explored through the comic book medium. I think they have to be open to that. I think that's important. And I think that, to your point, Barbara Gordon's tenure as Oracle, which was not done in The Killing Joke, but was done by John Ostrander later on, but that tenure as Oracle is what has defined her character, and I feel like what has drawn people to her over the years. People, I don't feel like, were drawn to Barbara Gordon because she dresses up like a bat and does the same things Batman does. They identified with Batgirl because she had gone through this incredible, destructive event that would have destroyed
anyone else.
And she ended up becoming arguably more powerful than anyone in the Bat family, and one of the most powerful characters in the entire DC universe by strength of will, by strength of her mind. And when she did go back to being Batgirl, she had that experience, and people had already been on that journey with her and identified with who she was and why she is who she is. So, that's my thoughts on that.
And one thing also that we need to keep in mind, you know, we say all the time there should be a character for everyone. There should be a character that everybody out there can, you know, reach out and grab onto. I have read online or heard the opinion expressed numerous times from people who suffered from some kind of, you know, ailment or what have you, who are handicapped or paraplegic or you know, wheelchair bound for whatever reason, that Oracle or Barbara Gordon for them was that character who they were able to find a common ground with, who reminded them of them. And again, that was not Alan Moore's intention. I can't sit here and say, oh, you have to love The Killing Joke because it gave us Oracle. But I'm saying, without The Killing Joke, you don't get those things. So there are positives that come with the negatives of what happens to Barbara Gordon here.
Right. And so anyway, we say all that to get back to... go ahead.
Sorry, and I want to just follow up. You were mentioning, you know, Alan Moore exploring themes such as Watchmen or whatever that, you know, were very adult you know, or themes in Watchmen that were very adult and some people would, you know, suggest shouldn't be explored in comics. The one I always point to, and one that's maybe a little more relevant to some of the stuff that happens here in The Killing Joke, is Brian Michael Bendis on Alias and his creation of Jessica Jones. And that story, essentially, for a long, you know, a long period of time, was the story of a rape survivor. It was a story about somebody who had been sexually violated and emotionally manipulated, and how they were coping with that trauma. And I would suggest that that's, you know, that's a great piece of literature. And for someone to say comics in general and superhero comics should not deal with those themes, that's a case of a book that dealt with them and dealt with them expertly, and a book that is critically and you know, commercially acclaimed at this point by both, you know, literary critics, comic book critics, and fans alike.
Right. Now, I feel like we've spent the whole time, because we have, talking about the book, and I do want to get to the movie. So the reason that we mention all this stuff about Barbara is the people that created this movie, Bruce Timm, all the people with DC Animation that have been there for years, James Tucker, etc., they felt, and Bruce Timm in particular has been clear that he was not a fan of The Killing Joke and didn't revere it the way that he revered Dark Knight Returns. But when they were doing this movie, they said, we've got to fix the Barbara situation. We don't want to do a movie where Barbara, where this happens to Barbara, and it's a standalone movie, and there's no redemption for her. There's no saving grace for her, and she's just an ancillary character. So they come up with this prologue, as you put it, the a prologue that shows Barbara in action as Batgirl, sets up the status quo of her fighting crime and trying to take down this this mobster character whose name I can't remember. Hey.
Paris, other, just a terrible name. But you say, you know, excuse me, the term prologue was actually used by the various creators in interviews and whatnot, and I feel like that's almost an unfair term, because the prologue takes up half of the movie, essentially.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's weird, because it's weird for me to be as, not to get ahead of us here, but to be as underwhelmed by this as I was, because it's written by Brian Azzarello. He did the screenplay for this, and Bruce Timm was heavily involved in it as well. And with the best of intentions, they create this prologue to try to strengthen the character of Barbara Gordon.
They are trying to reframe the story that eventually, you know, the back half of the film, they're trying to reframe it in such a way that Barbara Gordon seemingly has some sort of agency in the plot, and so that, you know, it doesn't seem like she's just victimized, like she has actually had some sort of role in the events of this film. Here's the issue with that, Greg.
Yeah.
One, and I'll speak to it from a sheer storytelling standpoint first, and not, you know, our own issues with plot or whatever. If you're going to try and reframe it so that she has a more active role in the events of The Killing Joke, then your prologue should actually, I don't know, have something to do with The Killing Joke. You could take this prologue and separate it entirely, and the two have nothing to do with each other. Now, I must pause here, Greg, and we're going to have to go and address this, because right now on screen is perhaps even more so than the shooting sequence, the most controversial scene in this film.
Oh my God. I know. Is this the lovemaking scene?
Right now, Barbara Gordon has just mounted Batman, placed a kiss on him, and
removed her shirt,
begun to disrobe on a rooftop.
I know the scene you're talking about. Now,
so before we address the rest of the prologue, we have to. It's here. We've got to address it.
We have no choice but to address it.
Oh, and wait a minute. Hold on. One other thing we've got to address before we address that. I don't know if you remember this guy, but what about 90s sitcom stereotype gay guy that was Barbara's friend?
Oh my God.
It was like watching the worst episodes of Will and Grace at times with this.
It was like it was like a parody. It was like
it really was a parody. It was like something. It was like a gay character you would see on early
in the
90s,
back when
early 90s.
Understand
SNL.
How to write actual like fully fleshed out characters. So just okay. That's another.
He comes off like a gay caricature,
right?
Essentially, but he's only in a few scenes. But I just wanted to call that out as especially not good.
No, it wasn't Batman grabbing Batgirl's ass. Not it just okay. Oh my god, I don't even.
So back to the sex scene.
Where do you want to begin with this? Do you want to begin with Bruce Timm's fascination with this weird relationship? Let's go there. I'll go there. Hell with it.
I suppose we should. Yeah. Which, for the record, we have to state, the Bruce Timm fascination with Batgirl and Bruce Wayne's romantic entanglement of whatever sort is now, for better or for worse, that is DC Animated Universe canon.
Absolutely. They made it that as of Batman
they
Beyond.
They made it that.
Yeah.
As of Batman Beyond and as of the comics work they did set in the animated universe.
Yes. It had no precedent prior to that at all. This is
creepy as hell. Here's the thing. Now, granted, this is not set in the animated universe, so forgive us for getting off on this tangent for a moment, though. But my reading of the animated universe was always that Barbara Gordon was absolute maximum 19. Maybe, and that is the oldest I am willing to think of her in that show. I always read her as more like, or listened to her, or watched her, and thought of her as more of a 16 to 17 year old. But she has not yet entered what I would call her mid-20s, you know, her adult period of life. She is still very much in late adolescence, as I would put it.
Yeah, and again, before we get into all this, I love Bruce Timm. I love Batman the Animated Series. I adore it. It's one of the greatest things ever related to comics. But again, even great things that we love have flaws, and this is a flaw. Like, there's no way to get around how creepy it is. And it's not creepy to me because Bruce is old and Bruce is older than her. It's not creepy because of any of that. My parents have a pretty significant age gap between them. Not that significant, but fairly somewhat. Some would consider to be significant. That's not what creeps me out. What creeps me out is
Sorry, but I have to call off this line of dialogue that Batgirl just uttered, by the way. It's just sex, for God's sake. We don't have to care. I don't care. You don't care.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Anyway, yeah. So the age difference is not what creeps me out about it. What creeps me out about it is the fact that she's the daughter of Bruce's best friend.
No, what creeps me out about it is the fact that you get the implication that Bruce has abused this mentor-mentee relationship and taken advantage of her in some way, even if she's a willing participant.
Well, yeah, there's that. But there's no getting around the fact that the relationship that we're presented with on Batman the Animated Series is, and in the comics as well, is that Bruce views Jim Gordon either as a friend or a father figure.
Or one of his most trusted allies. Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And
either way,
this would be like me going out with your daughter or something. It's unfathomable. It's like it's creepy. It's weird. It is not something that the character of Batman would ever, in my imagination, do. And it's made even more complicated by the fact that she's in a committed relationship with his surrogate son, Dick Grayson.
Yes.
And this is the guy, by the way.
In the animated universe as well. Universe, that's not just the comics thing that we're attaching
absolutely.
To.
Absolutely. And this...
So, let me ask you this. Why do you... Why? Why
have,
do you think...
I have no idea. I have a theory.
Okay, I'd love to hear it. Because I literally don't... I've never understood it. Like, I don't think it bothers me as much as it does some people. I just look at it and I go, man, that's weird. And I've never understood where it came from or what the reasoning or motivation behind it is.
I'm almost hesitant to even say this because I don't like it when people put their own thoughts in other people's heads as to why they do things. I really don't like that.
Well, we were never given a reason why this happened. That's the thing. In the animated universe, we were never given a compelling reason for these characters to be in a relationship.
My thought...
So we have to attach our own reasoning behind it.
My thought is that Bruce Timm, and I hate to even assume this, but my thought is that when he was young, he found Batgirl really hot in the comics, on the TV show, whatever it was, and he thought in his mind, oh man, she and Batman should hook up. And I think that relationship in his head stuck with him for his whole life. And so when he got around to doing particularly the Gotham Knights era of Batman, which is where this idea started, that was, you know, when they kind of revamped the show in 96, 97, I think that was him saying, all right, well, I finally got a chance to make my headcanon come true, basically. And for whatever reason, the characterizations didn't matter as much as the actual idea of Batman and Batgirl being together. And I think he was hell-bent on making that happen. And also, I think he wanted to use it as an artificial further barrier between Bruce and Dick for their split up, you know?
Which would – to use it as a mechanism to explain the Nightwing.
Right, right. And I think he combined those two things together, and he finally got a chance to fulfill his childhood fantasy. And I think to him, because he's probably thought of that since he was a kid, that's just the way it is that those two are destined to be linked together. It's the same reason, I think, by the way, he was so hesitant to do anything with the Bruce and Selina relationship on the show.
Right, because he had the Batgirl thing so firmly
entrenched in his head.
Okay, so the prologue is getting ready to wrap up here, so let's go back to that real quick. And we were talking
the sex
about
scene.
Well, we've done the sex. God, we haven't done the sex scene. Okay, the sex scene. How terrible is that?
This is what the overall point that I think we need to wrap up on this prologue. For as we mentioned at the beginning, all the best intentions in the world to make Batgirl a more important character to the story, to make her more than just the driving force for the male characters, and yet this ends up doing it far worse than the book ever did. Because she is reduced to a sex object for Bruce, and Bruce is more motivated now because Joker did this to someone that he secretly loves.
Right, and I think they tried to counter that by having her be the one that initiated the sexual contact or what have you, but it doesn't work.
Bruce Wayne, of all people, the master of discipline, who's supposed to be, who has resisted the sexual advances of Catwoman, just can't resist the sexual advances of this just-turned-college-age girl who's his student, you know? I can't buy it. It's ridiculous. It turns her into a motivating factor for Bruce that wasn't there before as much. Just it takes a bad situation, or it takes a controversial situation and flips it to where there's almost really no room for debate about it anymore, you know?
I agree. I understand what they were attempting to do, and I will say this. A for effort, F minus for
Absolutely.
Execution.
It is
disturbing to me that somebody I admire, and I know that the dude is controversial given his work on Wonder Woman and various other things, but somebody like guys like Brian Azzarello and Bruce Timm, who I typically mm-hmm. trust from a storytelling standpoint, failed so miserably with this prologue. So we both agree the prologue is awful. However, now we're going to get into what we all came to see anyway, because I don't think anybody came, or you know, went to the theater or bought this movie or rented it or whatever for the prologue. If you're renting this movie and you're a fan of the comics, you want to see the Killing Joke. And at this point, we're starting the Killing Joke.
Yes, and suffice to say, I would have been much happier if they had just done a 30-minute The Killing Joke movie.
Yep. You could have, and don't give me the line, well, it wouldn't have sold. Tales of the Black Freighter, which was a standalone animated feature, I don't think was more than, what, like 40 or 40
If that.
Minutes. Yeah. And we're speaking, of course, Tales of the Black Freighter is the animated tie-in they did to the Watchmen movie that adapted the comic within a comic portions of the graphic novel.
I bought it.
So anyway, here we go. The killing joke here, the story is opening with Batman discovering a group of bodies that have been Jokerized, and he's having this conversation with Harvey Bullock, about needing to speak to Gordon and that, you know, this and that and the other. And actually, is this the Killing Joke yet?
Yeah, I think.
Where does the Killing Joke begin?
You know, I don't know. I have a copy of the Killing Joke in a nearby room, but I'd have to leave the podcast to get it.
Well, don't worry about that. But anyway, now we've got Barbara Gordon running because she has to work out some frustration because one thing we didn't talk about is the prologue ends with her quitting as Batgirl because she and Batman had sex, essentially.
Yep. This is where the Killing Joke starts, by the way, this whole sequence here. Now, the jogging thing, I think, is added into the movie. That's not in the book.
Right.
In the book, she's just sitting in the apartment with her dad doing daughter-dad things.
Right. Making him a glass of cocoa or
whatever they do, yeah.
So anyway,
he responds, I'm fine.
If only. So I think we should talk about a little bit the level of anticipation for this, because as controversial as the book is, this is something that fans and even you and I had been clamoring for a long time.
Even the cast, Mark Hamill had been frothing at the mouth to do this movie for years.
Yep. Yep, he had been. And he had said that, you know, he's flirted with giving up the role numerous times, but he has always said that he would come back and do the Killing Joke even after he retired. And here he is. And that was really, you know, that was what we wanted. You know, what we came to see was not just the Killing Joke, but specifically Mark Hamill as the Joker and Kevin Conroy as Batman doing the Killing Joke.
Right. And to their credit, this adaptation part is really good, I thought. I thought it was, for the most part, almost completely accurate to what you see in the comics. There are some things changed. There are some things added. And arguably some of the changes were not great. But for the most part, it's a direct adaptation.
The dialogue is nearly wholly intact, which is really what you wanted, you know? One thing I want to talk about a little bit, and this kind of backtracks to the prologue just a tad, is the animation here. Typically, the DC animated universe or animated movies, the direct-to-DVD efforts, almost across the board have outstanding animation. This one, however, it seems as if the animation is getting a little bit of a divisive response online and in some fan circles. I want to get your thoughts on the animation.
I loved it. I'll be flat out honest. I remember I texted you, I think, or called you maybe when I left the theater, and that was one of the positive things I had to say about it. Because I enjoyed the adaptation part so well, I have a very complicated relationship with the recent batch, as in post-New 52 batch of DC animated films. I don't love the animation style of, for instance, the Flashpoint Paradox. Although it's a great movie, I didn't love the animation style of that. I'm okay with the animation. I think the animation in the subsequent movies has been good. The designs I haven't been crazy about. The more almost anime-style designs. This, to me, felt like part of the DC animated universe of the 90s and early 2000s. This was a more simplistically designed movie that some were disappointed that it didn't do a better job of mimicking Brian Bolland's artwork, which I understand, but that's really hard artwork to mimic. But
I think the complaint there was that the precedent that had been set by them attempting to animate Frank Miller and, you know, Frank Miller style in Dark Knight Returns, and specifically Mazzucchelli's style for the year. There was a precedent for
that. But my counter to that is Bolland's artwork is a lot more detailed. Mazzucchelli that's not a knock. Mazzucchelli in particular is an amazing comic book artist, as was Frank Miller in his day. But their styles were not as hyper detailed as Bolland's style. I don't know that you could mimic Bolland's style in an animated form. I like the idea that they went and they, to me, this looks like an evolution of the style of animation that you saw in the last few seasons of Batman the Animated Series.
True. One thing I want to call out right here is they've just transitioned into the first of the Joker flashback slash origin sequences. And I want to say I thought this was really well done, where these sequences, they wash out the color to give it that sepia tone almost that the book had for these flashback sequences. And also, I loved how Mark Hamill essentially did a different vocal performance for this portion of the movie. It's close enough that you can see or you can hear the link between this character and the Joker, but it's not a direct, it's not the same voice.
Can we,
I'm saying.
There's
enough distinction.
Can we call young Joker Jerome?
We can call him Jerome.
Yeah. Which that's a great segue into a point that I definitely want to make is, to me, this movie, for all of its warts, and there are a ton of warts, as we've mentioned, many of them. To me, this is Mark Hamill's magnum opus as the Joker. This is...
Right.
He is on fire from beginning to end. Whether it's as Jerome or as the Joker, he has a level of menace here that is beyond...
That he rarely had. I would say the only other time he's had it is maybe in the Arkham games, which had a little bit more of an adult... Mm-hmm. Dark bend to them, but he was never able to approach this level of menace, but not because he couldn't, but because he wasn't allowed to within the confines of the animated series, with the obvious exception of Batman Beyond Return of the Joker, where he had some of this as well.
You know what this it feels like? Sometimes, you know, when somebody's getting up there, and especially a legend in a field, and they have that one last shot to really knock it out of the park, and so they put everything into it. That's what this felt like. You know, it reminds me of Ric Flair versus Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 24. Not to tie everything back to wrestling, but remember, we thought that we were there and we didn't know what he had left, and for one night he dug down and he had that, because it was so important to him, he had that one last great performance. And this was, I don't know if this was his last great performance, but this felt like Mark Hamill putting every ounce of his passion, every ounce of his energy, every ounce of his soul that he's put 25 years into this character, and putting it out there and just gripping me every time he talked.
Absolutely. I mean, we don't know for sure that this is his last run with the character.
In fact, it won't be, because he's going to be on the Justice League Action show.
Ah, yes, Justice League Action, which I am nervous about, but that's another topic for another day. But you would have to figure that Mark Hamill, you know, he may or may not have some film projects he's going to be working on over the next few years that might take up some of his time, you know?
Right. And, of course, you're referring to the Trickster live-action movies.
The Trickster live-action film, yes. And also, he'll be appearing in the sequel, reprising his role as Cockknocker in the sequel to Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
And, Mark Hamill, amazing in this movie. Kevin Conroy, always great as Batman. What did you make of Mr. Conroy's performance?
Oh, Conroy is great. There's one particular moment that I want to address in a little bit that threw me somewhat, and we'll talk about it when we get there. But, I mean, Conroy is Batman, Mark Hamill is the Joker. Those are the voices you read comics. I mean, that's what you hear in your head. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just – they're iconic. They're beyond description at this point. One voice I didn't really like is this guy they have doing
– Agreed. Totally agreed. It was too
– Whereas
it was almost
all
too
of this,
weak of a voice, if that makes sense. It was too soft.
Too old man. Yeah. Too feeble old – too much of a feeble old man. Which would work for the tail end of the story when Gordon is borderline broken. It doesn't work for the portions right now where he's just normal Jim Gordon. So I wish it was closer to the animated series or something that feels more like Jim Gordon to me, but I really, really did not enjoy the vocal performance that they went with for Jim Gordon here.
I agree with you on that. I did like Tara Strong as Batgirl.
Oh, she was great, of course, even though her material was terrible. And here we are, Greg, the knock at the door, the wide-brimmed hat, the camera, the Hawaiian shirt, the gun pointed to the midsection, and Batgirl flying backwards in slow motion through the coffee table with blood splatter and twitching on the ground. So they earned their R rating.
Yeah. Here, very, very tough to watch. Like, I even, like, in the theater, even though I knew it was coming, the twitching is kind of what really made it uncomfortable to watch for me. And,
right.
Again.
And the Joker's one-liner about the spine being damaged when he calls her a coffee table.
Addition. Exactly. Which didn't make me laugh at all. It was like, it was one of those things.
Nor was it supposed to. I would wait.
It's that's the ultimate scary version of the Joker. The guy who thinks things are funny that are beyond what a human being could find funny. Basically, the anonymous internet person brought into realization. The anonymous, the people that say horrible things on the internet because they're anonymous, if they were a real person that would do it to somebody's face. And just a terrible, terrible person. And again, I thought this part was well done. I thought this whole sequence was properly rendered from the page. It was well executed. It was well animated, I thought. I know a lot of people disagree. I thought it was well animated.
I would agree.
I thought the acting was terrific across the board.
And you know, the scene ends with the shot of the Joker unbuttoning the top button of Batgirl's or Barbara's blouse. And so you can't really discuss this story or specifically that scene without addressing the elephant in the room, and that is the implication of what happens off-panel. Me personally, and I'm being 100% honest here, I have never read it, and even when I watch this, I have never consumed this story and gotten the implication that there was actual sexual assault, that there was actual rape involved in that scene. I know some people get that impression. I suppose I can see that, but I am just saying my reading of it, my watching of the scene here, that is not the implication I get.
I halfway agree with you. I agree with you. I don't think there's any reason to assume that there is sexual intercourse between the Joker and Barbara Gordon. I don't think that's even implied. I would still classify it as sexual assault though.
Oh, excuse me. I mean, I misspoke there, and I tried to cover that by saying actual physical rape. Yeah. You know, forced.
Right, I agree with you on that. I think it was certainly a sexual assault. It was not. There was no intercourse. There was no. I don't think that there's anything more that happened other than what you see in the book, which is just pictures of her with her blouse undone, basically.
Scantily clad, yes. Pictures of her in her underwear.
And I say just, and I don't mean to say just, but it's...
Right.
So it's there. You know,
and we apologize for just bludgeoning about such sensitive subject matter.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we're doing the best we can.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to talk about this story without talking about it. So, in any event, it's there and it's bad. And frankly, some of the implications of what is done to Jim Gordon, I got more implications even reading the book out of that than I did out of the Barbara scene.
Such as?
The stripping him naked and sending him alone, you know, through the weird amusement park that the Joker has. Even the first time I read the story, I assumed, especially how Gordon comes out crying, and I guess I looked too much into that, but I assumed that there was something inappropriate done to him in the state of undress that he was in the process of that, plus forcing him to watch what had been done to his daughter and all that stuff. Because that's the one thing is I've never understood the point of stripping him naked other than that.
I think the point, because he's caged later, is to say that you can take any human being and turn them into an animal and wipe away their humanity. And so I thought that was why he was stripped naked, to drive that point home further, to make him feel less human. Or that's the implication I always...
Yeah, I mean, the whole point, the idea is to put Jim Gordon through the worst day of his life and prove, which now that I'm thinking about it, the Dark Knight kind of took cues from Killing Joke, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because wasn't that kind of part of the Joker's deal, was proving that, you know, through Harvey Dent, who was a better person than Bruce Wayne was... proving that even the best person, when pushed to the edge, will go bad?
Yeah, absolutely. It absolutely was. It was there. And this is actually... right now we're getting Bruce and Barbara in the hospital. And I believe this is the last time we'll see Barbara for an extended period of time for the rest of the main
plot. And I believe this is also the second to last instance of added material that isn't in the book. Because I believe there is dialogue in this scene that does not exist in the book related to their previous encounters and whatnot.
And here they go ultra faithful to the book, complete with weird demon imp things that the Joker has of his...
Yes.
Cattle prodding Jim Gordon.
Evidently in the mid-80s, mid to late 80s, there was a fascination among Batman creators of giving the Joker really, really bizarre, borderline not human henchmen. Because if you recall, in Dark Knight Returns, he has these weird, like, exploding robot henchmen things as well. And in Killing Joke, he has these mutant things as his hench people.
Yeah. Certainly a unique
Certainly.
Situation.
It's a far removed from Bob the Goon.
Far, far removed from Bob the Goon. So now you have Gordon leashed up. You have the Joker delivering a big monologue about, how one day can take you places you don't want to be and that kind of thing. And you kind of have him ushering Gordon off into the ride, the funhouse ride or whatever it was, where he's going to see all the images of Barbara
and be treated and to an impromptu musical number.
Yes, which I'm going to assume was not in the book.
I don't remember it. I it's hard to tell with Alan Moore because he had a tendency to throw in weird random interludes like that. But I have to say, I liked it. I
kind of did too. I thought it worked. It. And, you know, it's funny because earlier I said too often the Joker doesn't have enough menace and has too much whimsy or what have you. But this felt simultaneously whimsical and menacing
right.
at the same time. I thought it was a perfect balance for
this version
of what the
Joker
can be.
Yes, it's – you could say whimsical, but when you take into context what the lyrics are – what he's saying and what's going on at the same time, it's terrifying.
Well, for the record, we haven't actually gotten to the musical number yet. But
right.
So
I'm assuming because I'm not watching it. But
right. No, we've actually just transitioned back into another flashback. So we got a couple minutes for the...
Which the flashbacks are some of the best parts of the whole thing in the book and the movie.
I would agree. This is the flashback where Jerome is about to find out from the police that his wife has died in a tragic baby bottle warming accident.
Very, very much. I don't know, Nick. Is that a relic of the 80s, or is that something that still could happen?
Baby bottle warming.
Yeah, I mean,
most people just use microwaves now.
Yeah.
Or run it under hot water. Like I will say that I have never used a baby bottle warmer.
I don't know. I mean, I don't. Quite frankly, I don't have any kids, folks. So I can only assume that there are some things in direct adaptations that you have to just take with a grain of salt, such as relics of the 80s and such. But that being one of them. Yeah, so when you look at the total picture of this movie, Nick, as someone who loves the book, where do you think this kind of worked, and where did it go astray? And let's disqualify the prologue, which we both agree was horrendous. But what elements do you think they got right, and what elements do you think that didn't work for whatever reason?
I think they got most of it right. I mean, I think the vocal performances are here, the dialogue is here, the story is here. The basic structure of it is all here. I mean, if you take away the prologue, like you said, which actually makes what happens to Barbara worse, in my opinion, if you just, like, if you started the movie halfway through just with the Killing Joke portion, I think it works. My only minor complaint would be I think there are times where the animation is wonky, where it isn't smooth or fluid. Overall, I like the visual style, but the quality of the animation itself I have issues with. Specifically at times when they try to use a hybrid of traditional animation and CGI animation, because the CGI portions stick out like a sore thumb.
I don't remember them, to be honest.
Specifically, towards the end of the film, when Batman is arriving at the amusement park, for whatever reason, they choose to CGI the merry-go-round when it comes on. Or not the merry-go-round, what's the carousel, excuse me, when it comes on. And it just sticks out like a sore thumb, because it is, and this is going to be a dated reference to our old columns and stuff, but if you remember when we did our off the page on Spawn, and I called out the terrible CGI in the title sequence, the CGI, when it's used here in this film, is to borrow a term from that column, PlayStation 1 era graphics. It is awful. Looks terrible. Looks blocky. Does not look smooth or like it fits in with the traditional animation at all. I do not understand why they chose to use it.
Nick, that's a problem that happens almost any time they try to combine CGI with traditional animation. It almost always looks stupid. And I couldn't tell you why they do it.
They also did it a few times earlier in the prologue in some of the chase sequences where they would have the Batmobile and the road and whatever car he was chasing be traditionally animated, but the buildings they were passing by or the crates at the docks and stuff would be CGI, and it stuck out like a sore thumb every time.
If you recall, they did it a few times in the first two seasons of Justice League as well, and there it was hit or miss whether it worked or not. Sometimes it was fine, and usually they just do it in the sequences where they were flying in the Javelin or whatever, to another planet or what have you. But yeah, I think that the adaptation part was really well done. The acting was outstanding. Seeing and hearing this dialogue performed by actors the quality of Conroy and Hamill, particularly as it gets closer and closer to the end, when we get to the climax of the movie. I was worried about it, Nick, because I think you understand why, because that dialogue, when you read it even, you're like, man, does anybody talk like this? Would anybody ever talk like this? And so for years, that was my biggest worry about the Killing Joke, because that is the story. Forget the flashbacks. Forget what happens to Batgirl. Forget what happens to Jim. The crux of this story, in order for it to work, is that last confrontation between Batman and the Joker.
The last 15 minutes of this movie, I would argue the last half of the movie, but specifically the last 15 minutes of this film are worth the price of admission alone. If you are a fan of the source material, if you like the Killing Joke, if you have an attachment to it, it's worth it. And that's one thing I want to address very quickly. I understand that the source material has its detractors, and some people have issues with it. My problem with some of the criticism that has been leveled towards this film is, and this is an argument I saw made whenever the new Ghostbusters movie was getting ready to come out. I read a couple articles where people, either directly said or heavily insinuated, the only reason the new Ghostbusters is getting a level of vitriol is because people have a love for the original Ghostbusters, and the original Ghostbusters isn't that good. That was a point that people actually tried to make, which is bullshit. I can understand people who didn't appreciate the Killing Joke to begin with, and that's fine. But for people to now somehow retroactively claim that the Killing Joke isn't that good, and that's why this movie isn't good, I have a big issue with that line of thinking. I still think the Killing Joke is a classic, and I don't think that this movie's, you know, failures, which it does have some failures, should in any way reflect upon the greatness of that original work, is what I'm driving at.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't like it, you don't like it, ultimately, the story. But I agree with your point that you shouldn't retroactively, change your mind about the book based on the movie.
Right.
And, you know, the like you said, that last 15 minutes, the closing sequence, gave me my money's worth. The ridiculous overpriced ticket I bought to go to the movie and watch this was worth it, because I got those chills that you get sometimes when you watch a piece of art that you've been anticipating for years, something that you personally didn't know would work, and it worked, because I didn't think it would work. I thought there's no way this dialogue is going to work being actually read by human beings, and they freaking killed it. They knocked it out of the park. The joke that he tells at the end about the guy with the shines the flashlight across the roof, and then the other guy's like, well, I'm not going to go across because you'll turn it off halfway through. That joke killed it in the theater. Everybody laughed because Hamill's delivery was perfect. And it's just such a well-done adaptation of that book sequence, complete with a killer fight between them leading up to it, which you don't usually expect to see good fight scenes with the Joker. And do we want to go ahead and touch on the epilogue as well?
Actually, let's hold on for a second, because I want to address that ending. The ending has also been a source of, I won't say controversy, but debate.
Yep.
And I'm talking about the book ending, not the ending here, which is pretty much what you see in the book. Coming up and with my first exposure to the story, and in subsequent rereadings over, you know, my first few years of fandom, I never read it with the idea in mind that Batman killed the Joker. What about
no,
you?
It never crossed my mind.
Right. And this, you know, this theory has been out there for a long time, and I'm certainly not saying that any one person is responsible for advancing it or anything like that.
Nor is there anything wrong with the theory.
No, nothing's wrong with the theory, but I feel like the theory got thrust into the public eye a few years back when Grant Morrison made some very public comments on a Kevin Smith podcast about it, and it kind of reopened the topic for debate, and that's kind of provided the opportunity for the ending to be discussed in a modern context, people, you know, what their feelings were on it long term. And that was my first real exposure to the idea that some people would read it as Batman killed the Joker.
Yep.
And I can say in subsequent years, I mean, it's been 2 or 3 years since that podcast was recorded and since that debate was kind of reopened, I've reread the source material, I think twice. And again, I still don't get it to this day when I read the source material. However, watching this, that's how I watched it. That was the implication I got from this version of the scene.
Really?
And I'll tell you why. The level of menace in the laugh from Kevin Conroy at the end was bone-chilling to me.
Yeah, I will agree.
It was something we had never heard from Conroy in all his years of doing the character. And I understand that you don't hear it because in the comics, Batman never laughs anyway. Like, that's kind of the point. But when he busts out the laugh at the end, it was nothing like what I expected it to sound like.
It wasn't goofy. It wasn't lighthearted. No. It wasn't somebody laughing at a joke. It was somebody laughing at a gallows.
It felt like it sounded like a mental break almost. Like if something in Bruce's head had finally just snapped in a way. And so I'm gonna go back and reread the book again at some point to see if I still read it the same way I always have. But I gotta say, on first viewing of this, my implication and my interpretation of the scene as it was presented here in this film is that, yes, Batman kills the Joker.
For what it's worth, and this also opens the greater debate of artistic intent versus artistic interpretation of does it matter what the author intended it to be, or does it just matter what the audience interprets it to be? That's a greater, broader question that goes way beyond this. For what it's worth, Brian Bolland, the artist, has said and has published transcripts of the script or copies of the script, and says there was nothing in there about Batman killing the Joker. However, when you listen to Grant Morrison explain it on that podcast, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
It does. It. I mean, like, especially as he explains it with the themes that are being explored throughout the story and kind of where they're building.
Even
it,
down
it does.
To the
it
title
makes a lot
being
of sense.
The killing joke. Because the killing for joke, years, right. even the way that you pronounce that, because I've always pronounced it as the killing joke. This is or the killing joke. This is like the killing joke. Like, the joke is literally killing. And right. As obvious as that is, I've never really looked at it that way. I just looked at it as, oh, it's a joke that's really funny.
Let me pause for 1 second to call out this outstanding – they nail this piece of the book. We are right now about to get in animation that classic, iconic image of the Joker taking off the red hood and looking into the camera and grabbing, you know, either side mm-hmm. of his head. You know, we've all mm-hmm. seen that image.
The
God
most famous Joker
image.
Times.
Yes, without, I mean, I would think without question, seconded probably only
with
by
with the
cover.
Hat, yeah.
Yeah, the cover with the hat. But yeah, there it is. And they pulled it off expertly. I would say that's one of the few moments in this book, or excuse me, in this film, where it did feel like they were aping Brian Bolland's style a little bit for that one particular
that
scene
and
one particular
those two,
image.
Actually. That and then the apartment scene.
Yeah, that's true, because they had the down to the Joker's eyes being replaced with just specks of light in the apartment scene. Yes. So anyway, back to our discussion of the ending. The killing joke. I mean, it. There's so many. You can read it either way. And like I said, just something about Conroy's delivery in this. I almost wonder if he, in his reading of the script, didn't take it that way. And right now on screen, by the way, Greg, I'm seeing that terrible CGI carousel that I mentioned earlier, and it sticks out just as badly in my second viewing as it did
in my
first.
And you could very well be right about that, because now that you mention it, the level of menace in his laugh was like you said, chilling. It was as chilling as Hamill's chilling Joker deliveries throughout. And even the context of their conversation of the Joker saying it's too late to come back from the edge, that there's no going back right. from what's happened now, could lead you to that interpretation. So it's very interesting. And
right, because it almost feels like Batman is giving him is giving his last best effort, and that he knows this is the last time he can try
it
to
save the Joker.
It feels
like Batman is clinging to hope, and when the Joker right. shuts it down, that hope is gone.
Right.
So, you know, very interesting way to look at it.
And you know, again, to go back to Conroy's delivery and performance in that scene, it furthers the theme of the dichotomy between the two characters, because, like you said, Hamill is so full of menace throughout this story and brings that across in his performance. And so when Conroy turns that on at the end and brings that level of menace, that bone-chilling nature to it like we talked about, it really further gets across the idea that these guys are just, you know, two opposite sides of the same coin, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's very well interpreted, very well done, very well delivered, and leaves you with that And here's another experience that I want to relate from the theater, because I did have that live theater experience. Everybody was so into it, but you could tell the people that hadn't read the book, because when that ending happened, you could have heard a pin drop in the theater. When after the laughter is over and it fades to black and it says the killing joke and brings up the credits, you could have heard a pin drop in that theater. And there was even somebody in the back that was like, "That's it?" And that is to the movie's credit, because that's how it's supposed to – that's how the book ends. The book ends and you're like – I remember the first time I read it, I was like, "That's it? That's the ending?" But that's the idea.
Yes, and let's come back to that in just a moment, because I want to call out the scene we made reference to a little earlier, but it just played out. As a longtime Jim Gordon fan, you know, he is certainly put through the emotional ringer in this story, but in the end, he proves the Joker wrong and proves that, you know, at his core, Jim Gordon is a good man, and that can't be changed or assailed, something that Bruno Heller would probably do well to learn from. But that's another topic for another day. But anyway, that line about "I want him brought in and I want it done by the book," that is one of the best all-time Jim Gordon moments.
That's a superhero line. Because, right, that's what separates superheroes from you or I. Because if I were in that situation, I'd be finding the nearest weapon and bludgeoning the Joker to death. But that's what separates these superheroes, the ideal of who we want to be, from the reality of who we are. It's what we want to strive to be. It's why at the end of the day, Batman is going to choose not to cross the ultimate line most times, because he's not us. He's different. He's what we can aspire to be. Same thing with Superman. And I think that Jim Gordon line is the ultimate just superheroic line, when you've been put through hell and back and you're still not going to violate your moral code.
Absolutely. And here we're getting kind of into that portion we talked about earlier, where they're really delving into the last few pages of the book, and we're getting that dialogue so expertly delivered, right down to the "if I'm going to have a past, I prefer it to be multiple choice" line. The lines that precede it, where the Joker is closer than he could possibly imagine to pretty much, like, calling out specifically what caused Bruce to become Batman, because he makes reference to, "I know something like that happened to you. I know you had a bad day. What was it? Was it your girlfriend getting killed by the mob? Was it your brother getting carved up by a mugger?" And he's like, "I know it had to be something like that, because something like that happened to me, too." And it's just, this is the point of the movie where, you know, as we said, regardless of how you feel about this story as a whole or about the prologue that was added or anything, I don't really see how you can have an issue with this last 10 to 15 minutes. This is just classic, all-time great Batman and Joker interaction here, specifically from the Joker with his
and as direct adaptations go, there's no way to do it better.
No. You know, we get everything that we need in this story. It is as faithful as The Dark Knight Returns was in its adaptation, you know, and that was also extremely, extremely faithful, that two-part animated film was. So, yeah, I mean, I think the best way to describe it in the sum total of its parts is there are flaws here. And there are there are almost bone-breaking flaws. There are things that I hate about some of the things that happen in this movie. But at the end of the day, the things that I hate are all things I wasn't really paying for in the first place. This is what I was paying for. This is what I wanted. And I have to say, in terms of delivering on my expectation for what I wanted out of this film, it gave me what I wanted.
Yeah, and
did it make me swallow one hell of a bitter pill to get to it? Yes. It is the equivalent of the young child who is forced to eat their broccoli and squash before they can get to the good part of the meal. But it was a hell of a meal once you got through the broccoli and the squash.
Yeah, and for the record, I'm not going to recommend this to everybody, because I have no issues if this material offends you, if you don't want to watch it, I don't blame you at all. I understand it completely. If you don't like the original story, don't blame you. It's your prerogative. If you do like the original story and you don't like the movie, you're not going to like a big portion of this movie because the prologue is
probably
most likely the prologue is not
yeah, because
good.
You know, it's weird because I have heard opinions online that there are some people who think the prologue actually is effective in terms of reshaping the story. I have read reviews where people,
I did too. Yeah.
You know, reviewers have said that, you know, they thought the prologue enhanced the story greatly and that it, you know, wound up making the story feel more complete and
right.
You know, lessened that terrible impact on Barbara. I don't agree with that. I don't see how anyone could get that out of it, but there are those that do. You know, I don't know. So, I mean, if you're
right.
out there and you're a huge fan of this book, you might find the prologue to be illuminating or enhancing
in
some way.
I will say, if
didn't.
You don't like the book, I don't think there's any way that you'll...
If you actively dislike the book, I don't think there's any way you will enjoy this.
And
here we are, by the way, Greg, with the delivery of the joke right now. Hamill is going into it, and even the animation is great here with the the body language and the hand signals and
the titular
pause.
Killing joke, if you will.
Yep, and here we are about to get Batman's actually going to crack, and there's the one little smile. And now he's starting to, calmly laugh. And here we are into the deep belly laugh. And here it is. The belly laugh is so, like, chilling. And then he puts his hands on the Joker's shoulders. And Joker stops laughing. But yet they continue with that chilling Conroy laugh. And in the book, you see the ha-ha-ha word bubbles before they both stop, you know. So you don't know off-panel who is still laughing and who isn't. In this movie, it's made very clear Batman is still laughing. The Joker is not laughing anymore. And Batman is laughing in a very, very, as we said, chilling way. So, like I said, I don't know that this is going to change the way I read the book, but my interpretation of the scene in animation, Batman killed the Joker.
Now, we also need to discuss the prologue, or the epilogue, I should say. Not the prologue, the epilogue.
That's right, and we are here in the credits now. The credits are rolling, and as the DC Animated Universe films have done for a little while now, from what I understand, I haven't watched as many of the recent ones as you have. We do get, in true comic book fashion, a mid-credit scene, and this mid-credit scene
is awesome.
Right now, we are seeing Barbara Gordon rolling into her apartment in her wheelchair, talking to her dad on her Bluetooth set, talking about how she's just gotten back from lacrosse practice. She's getting ready to play some wall ball this weekend. Clearly still leading a very active life. Here she is telling her dad that she's got plans for the night and can't hang out with him. And she hits a little panel on her wheelchair and rolls into her command center. It is the Oracle Command Center, straight out of the comics. Not with the clock tower, unfortunately, but this initial version of it. You get the impression that this is her first attempt at what would later become the full Oracle Nest,
yeah.
You know?
And I loved that post-credit scene. I thought it was
that,
amazing.
As an addition, unlike the prologue, actually does help in some ways to lessen the offensiveness of what happens.
Agreed.
To Barbara Gordon.
And for me, honestly, even if they had the prologue and they dropped the stupid subplot of Bruce and Barbara having a sexual relationship, I think it would have been fine overall. I think you would have had an arc for Barbara.
It would have been fine, but I don't think it would have solved any of the issues, and I think it was ultimately completely divorced from the plot of the Killing Joke and made no real sense. Like, there was nothing thematically to tie those two together. It felt like two distinct episodes of the animated series that were separate from one another, where the only plot tie was the awkwardness between Barbara and Bruce as a result of their sexual encounter. The actual, like, you know, plot of what is happening in that prologue has nothing to do with the Killing Joke. They could have done it better in so many different
ways.
The
other issue is a lot of the people in the theater had no idea what this credit scene meant. They didn't know what Oracle was. They didn't know that this meant that Barbara was fighting crime from her wheelchair. And so, and what's frustrating is, as great as that scene was, and it was a big fist pump moment for me, we're not going to get to see Oracle in action. You know, there's no sequel right. to The Killing Joke. So
there's no sequel to The Killing
right
Joke,
back to
and
the
only
DC
animated
universe, which right. presumably is going, which presumably has, they haven't used Batgirl yet in these movies that I'm aware of, but. Presumably, when they do, she's going to be back.
Wait, didn't she make her debut in a mid-credit scene for Batman Bad Blood, I believe it was? I believe she made her debut in her New 52 Batgirl of Burnside costume in the mid-credit scene for whatever the last Batman DCAU movie was before
The
Killing Joke.
Which fits my point exactly, because again, it's Batgirl, we're not going to get Oracle. We're probably never right. going to get Oracle in any meaningful form in a movie, which sucks, in my opinion. So that is unfortunate. But the scene itself is really cool, and I like the inclusion of it.
I agree.
So all that being said, if you've stuck with us this long through our rocky discussion of this controversial matter, we hope that you understand we did our best, and hit us up on the Facebook page, Place to Be Nation Comics. Hit us up on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. That's two L's on Phillips. And he is NickDuke87. And let us know what you thought about the movie. Let us know what you thought about our review of the movie. And just hit us up on this, because this is everything we just gave was our opinions on it, folks. But we are not the arbiters of what's right and what's wrong in the comic book world. So let us know what you thought about all these issues, and you know, give the movie a shot, see what you think about it. Maybe you'll like it better than we did. Maybe you won't like it as much as we did. I can say that it has made me reevaluate my stance on direct adaptations in animated form. I've been in favor of them to this point. However, now I'm kind of to the point where it makes me nervous, because I'm nervous that there is anything that is considered perhaps to need tweaking is going to be tweaked in a manner that will not be successful.
I can understand that concern, but I would counter with the part that was actually a direct adaptation was well done, I thought, as an adaptation. The issue is, this is the only thing they've ever tried to adapt that wasn't long enough to fill out the full 72 minutes. And I would say, in the pantheon of great DC stories, this might be the only thing that hasn't been done that's too short, as opposed to too long.
Right. I would, well... Yes, they did this
for The Man Who Has Everything has been done on the
and they had a
20
minute time limit, which was perfect for it.
Which was perfect.
They ran into this with Justice League or Superman versus the Elite, which is based on a standalone comic. Whatever Happened to the Man of or What's So Funny About Truth Justice in the American
About Truth Justice in the American
But that I thought was good. I thought the stuff they added in there worked. This less so.
Agreed.
So, anyway, but that being said, let us know what you thought about that. We've got some pretty cool stuff headed your way. Nick, what do we have headed the people's way?
Starting off with next week, it is the very first episode, the debut of a new recurring feature, Hard Travelers for Hire, in which we are going to take you movie by movie through the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe. We won't do it every month. We'll have some break months here and there for special themed months we have coming up, such as in October. We're going to have an entire Walking Dead month, so we won't be doing a Hard Travelers for Hire in October, but we're going to kick that off next week, Hard Travelers for Hire, with 2008's Iron Man, the movie that started it all. Going to be taking an in-depth look at that one.
We're going to have as a special guest on that episode, former senior WWE official Earl Hebner will be joining us.
Yes, Earl Hebner, and he will be reading us the plot synopsis periodically throughout the movie, just the plot synopsis over and over again. What do we got in 2 weeks' time? I believe, Greg, it is an edition of the Longbook Hunters. Is that correct?
Yes, that sounds correct.
Yes. In 2 weeks, we got the Longbook Hunters, and we're going to be taking a look at Kevin Smith and Joe Quesada's Guardian Devil from the Marvel Knights era back in 1998. A story that Greg's never read before, so I'm interested to get
which
his,
is a
his
Daredevil story, by the way.
Excuse me. Guardian Devil. It's a Daredevil story, for God's sake.
It could have been about Mephisto. You don't know.
That's true. And then, of course, in 3 weeks' time, we will be back with another edition of Countdown, in which we're going back to the Marvel well. We're going to be taking a look at the top five Marvel video games of all time, and we will be joined by a very special guest. I'm not exactly sure what his title is at this point. I think he got a promotion of some sort, but one of the Marvel bigwigs, Ben Morse. Editor of Marvel.com, I believe, although he may have gotten a different title at this point.
Up.
Executive editor. Something that involves him making a lot more money than Greg or I could ever, hope to obtain in life. So, Ben Morse will be joining us to talk the top five Marvel video games. And then, in the final week of September, we will be bringing you the second biennial Peter David Memorial Place to Be Nation Pop Fantasy Comics Draft, presented by a hypothetical DC Comics online unlimited subscription service.
Get ready, folks, because it's a doozy.
A doozy,
yes.
If you will.
It's a show that happened. It was
it
recorded.
It happened, yes.
And
it was.
Will be...
And we're going to share it with you, whether you want us to or not.
And it will be presented in all its heavenly glory. And speaking of Walking Dead month, we've got some cool guests lined up for Walking Dead month. The horror expert from 411 Mania, Joseph Lee, will be joining us to discuss Walking Dead, the pilot episode, I believe. He'll be helping us out.
We're going all the way back to the beginning.
Jennifer Smith, a hard-traveling fan girl, alumnus, will be joining us to talk about The Walking Dead. She's a big fan. We might have a few other guests lined up for you. And then if you can get through Walking Dead month with us, November is Scott Lobdell month at the hard-traveling fanboys.
Mm. Indeed it is. Indeed it is. So we'll be taking a look at... every issue of Red Hood and the Outlaws from the new
beginning 52. On, we're going to talk about some of the great changes and additions that were made to some of these characters, such as giving Arsenal a backwards baseball cap and what that did for the character and elevated him and how it made him relevant in the 21st century.
And having Starfire wanted to fuck everything that moves,
right.
Also. That was
We're going to get into having Jason Todd have been part of a magical supernatural cult when he came back from the dead instead of with the League of Assassins. We're going to get into a lot of this stuff that's really going to help show the modern genius of Mr. Lobdell. So we hope you tune in for that. And with all that being said, folks, tune in next week for another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Don't forget to check out all the other great shows on Place to Be Nation Pop, Sellers Points with new co-host Kelly Poole joining Russell Sellers, Todd Weber's Conversation Comics, what else we got? Lucha Undead, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular,
Rank and File, Imaginary
Stories. We've
Steffi talks too much.
And we've actually got a new podcast or two that are in the works to be debuted very soon, from what I understand. I don't want to announce those out of turn, so I won't, but suffice it to say,
Greg doesn't want to tell tales
out
of school.
That's right, Big Dan. And we will not get turned into a horny toad either. So with all that being said, folks, check out Place to Be Nation Pop, and don't forget about the mothership, placetobenation.com, all the great wrestling content there, sports content as well. Tune in next week, read some comics, send us some free comics that we can read, and we'll read them, and we'll review them. Adios.
Buy the shirt.
tonight.